Welcome to this special audio program developed from a satellite CME symposium held at the 2019 American Society of Hematology Annual Meeting in Orlando, Florida. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I first met with Dr. Dan Pollier, who participated in our live symposium, to discuss some of the recent advances in the management of patients with AML that were discussed at the meeting, as well as new data presented subsequently at the ASH meeting. So let's talk about the issue of intensive therapy up front or not. And we had a case that we presented, you know, we had this panel of 30 AML investigators that we asked a bunch of questions to. And we presented a 68-year-old patient with AML, performance status 2, history of hypertension, coronary artery disease, and diabetes with normal organ function. It turns out that most of the faculty panel for this patient would use azacitidine venetoclax. Actually, four investigators would go ahead with 7+3. A couple others would use decitabine and venetoclax. How would you think through this scenario?
This is never a patient that I would offer induction chemotherapy to. Now, you know, I mean, I think the times have changed, and a couple years ago, that would have been a different answer in a different era, not so long ago. You know, when we really didn't have any other options, we would take a lot of risks with intensive induction chemotherapy. And, you know, it was that or essentially nothing. But I think, you know, the goalposts have moved significantly now. And I think we have to rethink the question of who is an intensive induction chemotherapy candidate, because we're no longer in an era where there's a one-size-fits-all treatment, or we try to make it one-size-fits-all. We have a lot of different options. So not only is this patient, in my view, in my strong view, not an intensive induction chemotherapy candidate, I think a lot of other patients who may have been candidates in the recent past will be moving over into, you know, even despite being fit technically for that therapy, into being treated with a less intensive therapy.
And, you know, another thing that's sort of come out as we've seen the evolution, particularly of venetoclax combinations, is the younger patient who's fit, but their AML is such that you expect a pretty poor result from something like 7+3. So for example, we presented a 65-year-old patient with a complex karyotype and a TP53 mutation, and the most common answer chosen by our faculty panel actually for even this younger patient was a hypomethylating agent, venetoclax, mainly azacitidine. What about this kind of scenario?
I think this is a fascinating new era as well. I mean, I think we have to think about this very differently. You know, when we say fitness for induction chemotherapy, what we're really saying is how likely is it for the patient to not die with chemotherapy? But we're not giving any thought to how likely is it for their disease to actually respond. Amazingly, that's become an afterthought. And so I think, you know, you're seeing the reflection of, you know, with your poll results and what people are actually saying they would do is an acknowledgement of this fact that even if a person may not die with chemotherapy, the fact that their disease is so unlikely to respond to this intensive strategy, and this patient has all those features, the complex karyotype, et cetera, I think we need to think about this as, is there disease fitness for induction chemotherapy? And, you know, regardless of whether a patient may not die with this treatment, you know, is their disease sort of likely to respond? And so that's a big part of the consideration now, or should be.
So I wanted to hear a little bit about, kind of get an update on where we are today in terms of venetoclax combinations. But in terms of some of the specifics, one of the things we see in this poll is a little bit of divergence about the partner. As I mentioned, mainly azacitidine, but also some decitabine. In this particular poll, we didn't see any low-dose ARA-C. But how do you think through those options in terms of venetoclax partnering? And when you do use hypomethylating agent, what kind of schedule?
Great question. So, I mean, I think the first question with respect to the backbone therapy or the partner therapy, like you said, I mean, I think in this country, the low-dose cytarabine option is usually not an option. And that's because of historically, just a lack of familiarity with that drug in this country, a lack of access to it. And so, you know, in this country, I think the real decision making is around hypomethylating agents. The other thing about low-dose cytarabine, and we learned a little bit more about this at this past ASH meeting, is that, you know, when you try to compare results from one study to the next, which of course everyone would tell you is not a completely fair thing to do, but something we all do, the response rates for the low-dose cytarabine backbone are not as good as the hypomethylator backbone. And I think there are some explanations for that. The patient populations weren't exactly the same. But I think there is some emerging data or sense that, you know, for the very susceptible populations to venetoclax strategies like NPM1 or IDH mutated, they can do real well with a low-dose cytarabine. But the poor risk historically patients, like the adverse risk cytogenetics and those types of patients, I think there is a bit of a signal around those patients not doing as well with a low-dose cytarabine. But when it comes to the second part of the question, which hypomethylator to use, I think the jury's still out. I mean, there's never been a comparison, and a lot of this comes down to your comfort level and things like that. I think it is, you know, I think there is perhaps a signal that azacitidine has a little bit better long-term follow-up with respect to disease-free survival, remission duration, and overall survival. I think that's yet to be seen, but, you know, it's also important that the phase 3 study with hypomethylating backbone therapies, which is accrued and we're waiting for results, only looked at azacitidine. And so whether or not that's a reflection of a belief of which therapy works better or more of a business decision, I do think at some point most of the data is going to be around azacitidine as the backbone.
So, you know, one of the things that was presented at ASH after our symposium was the big QUASAR study looking at oral azacitidine. And I was curious what you thought about that, both in terms of the immediate potential application in that trial, but also maybe future applications and maybe a hypomethylating venetoclax combination that could end up being all oral.
Yeah. Well, you know, the QUASAR presentation at the late-breaking session of ASH was, in an odd way, it's very dichotomous. It was both revolutionary and very sort of not revolutionary. So I'll try to explain. I mean, what this study showed was that patients treated with an intensive induction regimen who achieved a remission and did not go on to transplant, they could get consolidation, and some did, some didn't. If you parked those patients on oral azacitidine, CC486, versus a placebo, they had a strongly significant improvement, I think both statistical and as well as clinical improvement in their overall survival. So why this is revolutionary is that this is a whole new treatment paradigm that we don't have in AML, an intervention that was fairly well tolerated. And it has led to, you know, a new treatment landscape, a maintenance therapy opportunity in AML. So that's really revolutionary. And the implications of this are dramatic. You know, anyone in a remission, potentially you could extrapolate that this could be of benefit post-transplant, post-consolidation, or maybe people who get into remission with low-intensity therapies. The reason this is a little more less applicable today is that, you know, the vast majority of patients in our practice who are fit for intensive induction chemotherapy, you know, they go on to get a transplant. So there's no sort of long-term plan with just maintenance alone. Now, there's some subsets, the good risk subsets that, you know, we typically stop after induction consolidation. So it's not as if everyone goes to transplant. And there certainly are some patients that you induce and then they go from being a good transplant candidate to not being a good transplant candidate. So that's an opportunity there too. But at the moment, like if this were widely approved and at our disposal, I don't have too many patients that I think would fit this exact criteria. But like you said, it's more the sort of like long-term implications. Oral azacitidine, think of all the places we use azacitidine in MDS with venetoclax. We had all these other presentations at ASH after our symposium, using it with Glastegib, using it with IDH inhibitors. There's all these opportunities to have all oral regimens in AML, and that would be a dramatic shift. I do think that we're not ready for that yet. I think that even though this is oral azacitidine, the pharmacokinetic properties of this are different than the standard conventionally dosed azacitidine. And since despite decades of work with azacitidine, we still don't really understand how it works, I think we need to be really, really cautious about this, because just because it's the same molecule, changing the pharmacokinetics could, I think, change the efficacy. So I think we need to have clinical trials in each of those subsets. But clearly, the implications of this are huge and really exciting.
So when you look specifically at, for example, azacitidine venetoclax in AML, which we're going to talk more about, how much do you think it would affect sort of quality of life if you could use an oral hypomethylating agent in that situation?
I think it would be dramatic. I mean, I think, you know, this therapy, venetoclax plus azacitidine, you know, in the case we're talking about, the majority of patients respond, and then the long-term remission duration is quite good, and not to mention the overall survival. And, you know, there are patients in my practice, and I know others who've been doing this for several years, who are, you know, getting onto the four-year mark here. And I don't think azacitidine was ever designed to be given for that long of a period of time. And over time, it really wears on patients. You know, the logistics of coming into an infusion center for a week every month or every 6 weeks, the toxicity associated with that, the time spent in the infusion center, the quality of life impact, and that has a direct impact on compliance, frankly. So if we think that it's best practice to keep these two drugs together for as long as possible when patients achieve a remission, it's really limiting our ability to do this with these sort of quality of life logistics issues. So the ability to have an all-oral regimen that could, you know, replicate the results of what we're seeing now would have a dramatic effect on quality of life. And indirectly, you know, it could improve outcomes, because to the extent that patients are having a shorter duration of remission because they come off the azacitidine or delay the azacitidine for logistics reasons, that could on the back end turn into better outcomes.
You know, kind of reminded me of myeloma. And there you have an oral proteasome inhibitor, exazimib, that's come onto the scene. When that first came in, kind of similar scenario. One of the things I thought about is not only might you get better compliance, but maybe by using, you know, a longer-term oral, you actually change the pharmacokinetics of what the patient's being exposed to.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, that's very clear with oral azacitidine. That was presented in one of the slides at that late-breaking session. The pharmacokinetics are different. The dosing is different. And yeah, I mean, I think looking at the glass half full perspective, you know, maybe we make this work even better. You know, maybe that's the outcome of it. The other perspective, of course, is that we lose the sort of magic that allows this to work. And so I think we have to be really cautious. But yeah, I agree with you. There is the possibility that an oral delivery mechanism with altered pharmacokinetics could improve outcomes alone.
So you talked about the magic, and I'm curious what your current thoughts are. We've been talking about this for the last couple of years, about what's really going on, the biology, the mechanism of action, why, if you believe there is a synergy, which there seems to be, what's actually going on molecularly when you give a hypomethylating agent and venetoclax, or low-dose IRC for that matter?
Yeah. I'm really glad you asked, because I think this is really important, and I spend a lot of my time thinking about this and working on this. So our group has published a couple papers in the last couple years, basically showing that this regimen, specifically venetoclax plus azacitidine, has a unique ability to specifically eradicate leukemia stem cells. So leukemia stem cells are this sort of rare, small subpopulation of the disease that resists chemotherapy, isn't usually susceptible to that strategy, and is the source of relapse when it occurs. And as you know, in AML, that's almost always, really, is the kind of monster we're dealing with. And so for many years, we've been trying to identify what are the features of leukemia stem cells that might differentiate them from other cell types in the body, and then by extension, what are their weaknesses? And in the recent past, we've come up with one particular weakness that's really compelling, and that's a sort of Weakness in the way leukemia stem cells do metabolism. Metabolism being the essential sort of responsibility of all cells to burn energy, to make energy, to stay alive. And leukemia stem cells, for reasons we still don't really understand, are completely inflexible in their source of energy and the way they do metabolism. So they rely almost entirely upon amino acids, and they prefer to use those amino acids for something called oxidative phosphorylation. So that's all fine and good, but how can we exploit this? That's the beauty of this regimen, is that it shuts down the ability to take up amino acids and to do oxidative phosphorylation. And, you know, other cell types in the body, they really don't care. If you take away one form of metabolism, they'll switch to another. Leukemia stem cells, at least the ones that are susceptible to the venetoclax regimen, which are most, they completely collapse and die from this. So we're really, really excited about that new mechanism for killing a cancer cell, in this case, a cancer stem cell. And in terms of what we learned more at ASH, I think the one sort of message that's starting to come out is that, you know, although we're really happy with a 70% response rate, which is about what we're seeing, you know, pretty consistently across studies, 30% of patients do not respond. And what we've found is that their leukemia stem cells do not have this metabolic inflexibility. They, like other cell types in the body, are able to use other sources of energy in the body to do metabolism. And so how to predict that subpopulation of non-responders has been a huge challenge. And, you know, cytogenetics and molecular tests really don't identify those patients well. But at this meeting, we, for the first time, are starting to have some clues about how to identify that 30%. And I think it's really fascinating.
What are those clues?
Right. So back 20, 30 years ago in AML, AML was categorized by morphology, by the way the cells looked under a microscope, right? The French, American, British system, some people who have been practicing for a long time would recognize that. That's really fallen from favor the last 10 to 20 years. Most pathologists won't classify AML by the FAB classification system because it's, you know, kind of anachronism and there's no biological differences between those disease types. But what we found, and this is actually several other groups have found this as well, is that the FABM5 subgroup, the monocytic AML subgroup, they appear to not respond very well to venetoclax-based regimens. And in our hands, this is the only multivariate predictor of being refractory to venetoclax. And this has been actually now confirmed by a group in Finland who published a paper recently that if you do look at the old FAB classification system, FABM5, the monocytics, they do not respond well to this. The biology of this is fascinating and it gets maybe a little bit into the weeds here, but basically what we're finding is that those are the patients whose leukemia stem cells who are not dependent on this one type of metabolism. So I think in the future, in the very near future, what I'd like to see, what I hope to see, is that we're going to identify these likely non-responders based on morphology and based on other flow characteristics of these patients, and we're going to give them other therapies. And I think that's where the future is heading.
And you mentioned the subset, the FAB subset. Is that something that you're bringing into your practice clinically?
At the moment, we don't have a real outlet for this, unfortunately. So when I see an FABM5 patient who isn't an induction candidate, I don't have a whole lot else to offer. And so, you know, interestingly, I will say, even though FABM5 is a multivariate predictor of a poor response, we do have some FABM5 patients who have responded and have responded well. So it's not a 100% thing. We are working very hard, and I know others are too, to try to get at the underlying biology of this and have a real solid predictor outside of morphology, which, as you know, is a little subjective. One pathologist might call M5, another might call something else. But the bottom line, I think, is that at the moment, I mean, this is something that I don't have another, you know, viable therapy for outside of a patient with a targetable mutation. And so I really just cross my fingers and hope for the best. But I hope in the next year or two that this is going to become an active line of investigation and we're going to have clinical trials that are specifically dedicated to patients with this biology.
I'm curious, though, just to get a little bit more into the synergy between venetoclax and a hypomethylating, why do you need both? Is that just an empiric thing, or do you have sort of a rationale?
That's a great question, too. So if you were to have asked me a couple years ago, I would have said, you know, this is kind of silly. Venetoclax is doing all the heavy lifting. The study design required azacitidine because that was the standard of care and you couldn't deny a patient that treatment. I've really evolved on this based on the data, the science, and this is, again, something that our group did. When we modeled this in vivo with just venetoclax, we didn't get this sort of metabolic targeting of the leukemia stem cell population. We also didn't get that with azacitidine alone. We really had to have both together. The reason that is still a work in progress, I'll be honest with you, and that's an active line of investigation in our group and probably others. So I can't really tell you what's doing what and why we need both, but what I do know, and I'm pretty confident about, is that we do need both of these treatments to be effective. Now, Andrew Wei's group, they presented some data at the ASH meeting after our symposium that was pretty compelling that there are some subsets that were responding to venetoclax single agent. So I think that's something that we, you know, are very interested in looking at further. But in our hands, you know, this sort of magic on a synergistic combination to target the leukemia stem cell population, we did need both azacitidine and venetoclax.
You were talking before about this issue of longer-term therapy and the challenge of keeping patients on azacitidine or decitabine. As you sort of look out at it right now, clinically, I know we don't have much research data, but clinically, how do you approach the issue? How do you think people should approach the issue of discontinuing one or both of the agents?
Well, you know, this is an active research question. So, you know, we have a clinical trial right now that's designed to specifically attempt to answer the question of, is there an end date for the azacitidine and is there a time when you can stop it? You know, we think that perhaps if you get to an MRD negative state with both therapies using a very sensitive MRD assay, that you might be able to justify stopping the azacitidine. But that's really, like I said, a clinical trials question, and we hope to be able to have an answer in the near future. At the moment, it's really hard to know what to do in general clinical practice. I mean, I think our general recommendation is a patient who's achieved a remission and is doing well, do your best to keep them on the therapy. But that's, you know, a lot easier said than done. People don't live close. People, you know, have other life events that come up. And so at the moment, I think that's the best we can offer. But clearly, we need to do better.
We asked a couple questions also about sort of the nitty-gritty of using venetoclax combinations. And one was the issue when the first bone marrow evaluation should be done. And in general, it looks like it's sort of either the end of the first cycle or towards the end of the first cycle. And we hear a lot of questions from docs who are using these combinations about cytopenias around that time. So can you talk about what typically happens and, you know, how you approach managing it?
Absolutely. This is really crucial because even if you're an avid reader of the literature, the clinical trials, you're not going to appreciate a lot of the subtleties of how, like you said, the nitty-gritty details of this are managed. And these are really important details. So it's essential on this treatment that an end of cycle one bone marrow biopsy is performed. In our group, that means day 28. So a lot of people have an attitude from an earlier era when they were just giving azacitidine alone as sort of a palliative strategy, that there's no point in doing a bone marrow biopsy until cycle four, cycle six. You know, that's how long it could take for a patient to be in a remission, or maybe even no bone marrow biopsy, just watch the counts recover. That is not translatable to this situation. I'll tell you why. There is more myelosuppression by adding the venetoclax to the hypomethylating agent. And this is a manageable issue, but only with proper breaks and treatment interruptions. And so during cycle one, just like you would with azacitidine alone, you expect for cytopenias to occur. That is, you know, I don't want to say 100%, but that should be the expectation. And during cycle one, before you can document a remission, that's not a reason to stop therapy, to hold therapy, to make any changes, just as it's not in the setting of azacitidine or induction chemotherapy. You know, we in the leukemia community, we're pretty familiar with sort of like plowing through and being aggressive and staying on schedule. But At that day 28 time point, we take a break, we do a bone marrow biopsy. And if a person is in a morphologic remission, so if the blasts are less than 5% of the bone marrow, regardless of count recovery, usually there's, you know, still some myelosuppression at that point, then you take a break. Okay, and so this is crucial. If you plow forward right into cycle two, either without knowing if you're in a remission or documenting the remission, but just trying to stay on schedule at that point, you will profoundly suppress the patient's bone marrow and cause significant problems for a patient in a remission on the back end. So that first bone marrow biopsy is really crucial. If you're not in a remission, be very worried because this works fast. This isn't azacitidine or decitabine alone. Median time to response is usually one cycle. So you could justify moving forward with a second cycle if there's evidence of response, but you're not all the way there yet. In that case, there's no reason to wait or to delay. Just go right into cycle two. So another really important reason to know what's happening on day 28. If you are in a morphologic remission, take a break. We give routinely 2 weeks off, no therapy, no venetoclax, no azacitidine, and we even give growth factors very routinely in that setting. And patients' bone marrows with respect to neutrophils are often really on the verge of coming back. Often it's just like one or two doses of Neupogen, and you've got a normal neutrophil count in that two-week period off treatment. And platelets often recover nicely too, maybe not fully to, you know, a normal range, but clinically manageable thrombocytopenia. And so that's a super important principle of the treatment of this disease, early bone marrow biopsy and breaks between cycles.
What do you see in the peripheral blood?
So that's really fascinating. I mean, not just the peripheral blood, but on rare occasion when you have extramedullary disease with this treatment, in almost all cases, interestingly, even in cases where you don't later find a marrow remission, we see rapid resolution of extramedullary disease, whether that's circulating in the peripheral blood or, you know, we've had the rare patient who comes in with the neck mass or something like that. So this treatment is very, very good at getting rid of disease outside the bone marrow. So in almost all cases, when we've had circulating disease, it's gone within a couple of days. It's really, really fast. Now, I also want to just point out, we are talking here about untreated patients, newly diagnosed patients. It's a completely different conversation when you're trying to use these therapies in the relapse setting. But so all of this conversation really just applies in the upfront treatment setting. I think that's important for people to appreciate.
So a couple other supportive care issues. We were talking about cytopenias. We asked the faculty panel what kind of prophylactics they utilize, and generally acyclovir, allopurinol, quinolone, antifungal therapy. Do you agree with that? And specifically, do you use fluconazole? And if so, do you change the dose of venetoclax?
Yeah, so great issues, active issues of considerable debate right now. I'll tackle the tumor lysis syndrome prophylaxis first. So allopurinol should be used in every patient or some type of uric acid lowering agent. It's very important. Tumor lysis syndrome is rare, admittedly. In the clinical reports that we have in the hypomethylating agent plus venetoclax, there were no reports of clinical or laboratory tumor lysis. In the low-dose cytarabine paper, I believe there were two cases of laboratory tumor lysis syndrome, not clinical tumor lysis syndrome. But remember, aggressive mitigation against tumor lysis syndrome was done in the context of those clinical trials. So, you know, it's, I think, a little cavalier to assume that tumor lysis syndrome is not something to worry about, because in those clinical trials, we were very worried about it and we took aggressive measures to mitigate against that. The allopurinol, like you mentioned, the dose escalation of the venetoclax, the fluids, the careful monitoring of electrolytes, the inpatient stay for the ramp up, all those, you can't dismiss those mitigation techniques when you say, well, there was no tumor lysis syndrome. So that one is, to me, an easy question with respect to the allopurinol. The anti-infection prophylaxis is a much different issue. And, you know, this gets to the heart of a debate that really has been raging in our community for decades and has never been solved. And there are some practices and people that are very committed to prophylaxis. And I would say probably fewer, but a significant number that are equally committed to no prophylaxis. And both groups sort of, can go to war with each other and have passionate discussions about why the other group is wrong and they're right. But in the end, there is no data, solid data, to support either approach. And so it comes down to comfort level and your training background. I think with either strategy, if you're a prophylaxis person or not, there's room to use this regimen. And so I personally do not use antifungal prophylaxis with this regimen. The fluconazole that you mentioned, if that is an important sort of precept of your approach to AML, it can still be done in the context of venetoclax, but you do need to follow the dose decrease guidelines that are in the package insert. So, you know, azoles are CYP3A4 inhibitors, and they can interfere with venetoclax, and they can induce the levels of venetoclax to higher effective doses. And so you need to, if you're going to use an azole, you need to decrease the dose of the venetoclax. So in the package insert, I think they mostly discuss posaconazole, and the recommended dose decrease is, you know, from 400 milligrams is actually 70 milligrams. 70 milligrams in reality is a little hard to get your hands on in the AML world. I know a lot of people just dose decrease to 100 milligrams instead. And fluconazole, some people feel, is not as strong of a CYP3A4 inhibitor, so they might do a 50% dose reduction with the venetoclax. You can't go wrong following the package insert, but I guess the message that I have is you don't really need to adapt your practice. You can keep doing what you've been doing, but you do need to sort of pay attention to those realities. And, you know, if you want to dip your toe into the argument of prophylaxis versus not, I think keep an open mind, you know, either side of the fence that you're on.
So getting back to the issue of tumor lysis syndrome, it's interesting you mentioned the issue of admission to the hospital, which my understanding is what was done in the clinical trials. But yet when we ask the investigator panel, actually the majority, about three quarters of them, say they don't think necessarily the patient does need to be admitted to the hospital. What's your practice?
Yeah, well, you know, our practice is to admit everyone to the hospital for the dose ramp up, and we have patients stay in for 24 hours past the maximum dose. So if it's a 400 milligram target, then they'll stay in 100 milligrams, 200 milligrams, 400 milligrams, and they'll go home the next day. So like day four. And that works well for us, I have to admit. I mean, that's mostly out of habit. It's just how we've done things, and we're comfortable with it, and we have it down to a, you know, a pretty routine protocol, and people do well. And so I know that many of my colleagues are not doing that routinely, and I think that's okay. I will feel a lot better about transitioning to the outpatient space when, you know, when there's some published data with some guidelines there. So in CLL, when we use venetoclax, we have nice guidelines kind of giving us the risks of tumor lysis syndrome and, you know, what risk factors to look for and which patients to admit and how to mitigate against tumor lysis syndrome. I'd really like to see that in AML to give me a little bit more confidence before kind of committing to doing it in an outpatient setting. But yes, a lot of my colleagues have made that transition. I do want to mention, though, those colleagues are people who work at large institutions, and even though they're doing this outpatient, you know, they have the capacity to have patients wait around for long days to check electrolytes and kidney function in the several hour increments after the venetoclax is given. And they have the potential to rapidly admit a patient and things like that. So I think in that infrastructure, in that setup, it's different than a setup where you don't have those capabilities. And I would just want to impress upon people to not be cavalier about this and to take it seriously because, you know, I mean, tumor lysis syndrome is a big deal, and that can cause major comorbidities that I think are preventable. So I would just have a lot of caution.
So you mentioned CLL, and there one of the issues in the package insert is the white count. Of course, those are lymphocytes, big difference, but in some cases they'll debulk patients with, you know, anti-CD20, et cetera. What about patients with high white counts with AML getting venetoclax HMA?
Yeah, we have really no problems with doing this for these patients, and we routinely do. And a lot of the patients that were treated on the clinical trial, they were pretty proliferative. However, you need to, like you said in CLL, you need to debulk these patients. At least when they have a high burden of circulating disease, it's really important to get that blood count down. Now, in the clinical trial, everyone had to be below 25,000 to be on the study. So everyone you read about in all those papers, that was the reality for them. And we all know there are patients that you just can't get down. You know, I mean, there are those patients, and those patients were not included in the clinical trial. So treat those patients at your own risk and know that you're off the map if you have one of those unfortunate patients that you can't cytoreduce with things like hydroxyurea or even leukapheresis. We've done both of those things to get a patient down into range where we'll feel comfortable initiating the regimen. In most cases, we've been able to make that happen, at least in the now approved setting outside clinical trials, at least to get in that neighborhood. And that's definitely a patient you'd want to be treating inpatient and be very careful about tumor lysis, of course. But that is an important principle to recognize, that I wouldn't just go in, you know, guns blazing with the patient with 100 white blood cell count. I'd do some work before starting the treatment to get that down.
So you mentioned the randomized trial that's ongoing. But I'm curious right now how you view, or what you might communicate to a patient who wants to hear about it, the outcomes that you would expect from just a hypomethylating agent in this situation, and what outcomes right now you would expect from adding venetoclax.
Yeah, great question. So yeah, there are two clinical trials that are ongoing right now. One is low-dose cytarabine plus placebo or venetoclax. The other one, as we mentioned before, is azacitidine plus placebo or venetoclax. So let me comment, like you asked, on the azacitidine. I mean, what I used to tell patients, or what I tell people now, is that, you know, if we're going to treat your AML, you know, in an unfit older patient with azacitidine alone, the expectation would be something like a 30% response rate. And that response would last, you know, 9 to 12 months. What we've seen in the phase 1 study of venetoclax plus azacitidine with, I think, close to 100 patients, and this is also reflected in our routine clinical practice, is about a 70% response rate with the combination. And, you know, a median duration of response that's looking like somewhere around a year and a half. You know, the jury's still out, I think, on long-term overall survival. We just don't have an updated report on that yet. So it's a little hard to have an expectation there. But you would imagine that with such a dramatic increase in the response rate, that would translate into a longer survival. But, you know, that's why the clinical trial is being done, to show that.
What do we know right now about mechanisms of resistance? Why do these remissions not continue?
Great question. Very little. Before talking about mechanisms of resistance, though, let's just talk about what happens when people stop responding to this regimen. The MD Anderson group had a very nice presentation about outcomes after relapse from venetoclax plus hypomethylator, and they're scary. I mean, I think the median survival was 2 months. So that's a reflection of the landscape right now. I mean, venetoclax filled this enormous hole in our treatment paradigm, but when you relapse after that, you're back to nothing that we have for you. If you're not a candidate for, you know, an intensive salvage regimen, you have very few options. So, you know, the best outcomes that the MD Anderson group showed were people who had a FLT3 or an IDH mutation that could be exploited. Outside of that, it's really bad news. What's happening to cause this? Well, you know, this was data that our group presented, Shanshan Pai from our lab, back to that monocytic disease phenotype that confers resistance upfront. What we've also shown, and what Shanshan presented, is that at relapse, the disease is, in many cases that we've seen, is pushed toward a more monocytic phenotype. So it's very similar to the mechanism of resistance that gets sort of squeezed out at the time of relapse. So whereas at diagnosis, you may have only teeny tiny population with these monocytic or resistant features, at relapse, that encompasses the majority of the disease. So that's at least one major contributing factor. We're also seeing the RAS pathway pop up as an important likely mechanism for resistance or relapse. And, you know, RAS pathway abnormalities are also being shown or implicated in relapse with IDH inhibitors and FLT3 inhibitors. So there's some sort of final common pathway where these therapies are pushing the disease toward this resistant pathway. So RAS would be NRAS, KRAS, other RAS family members, PTPN11, and less common one called Cbl, NF1. So there's a couple of these that are way overrepresented in the relapse setting. So I think those are things to look out for and things to really try to focus new therapies around.
This mechanism in terms of the stem cell metabolism that you've been talking about, where else do you see that? I think in the past you mentioned to me that some solid tumors have this phenomenon. In general, where do we see it?
Yeah. So there are probably a half dozen to a dozen papers now showing other cancers, almost all solid tumors, whose cancer stem cells have this exact same property, this odd weakness where they're totally dependent on one type of metabolism. So, you know, nothing I think is ever easy in cancer research or cancer biology, but is really compelling to see that, you know, there is maybe some, you know, common across the board weakness of cancer stem cells that we're illustrating with leukemia stem cells, but has also again been shown in all these solid tumor settings. And the ones that come to mind, breast cancer, colon cancer, pancreatic cancer, a bunch of others. And so could this be exploited similar to its, you know, exploitation in AML in these other solid tumors? I think it's a provocative question, and I hope my colleagues who do work in these areas would take an interest in this and see, because I think it's a possible target.
What about the issue of using this kind of strategy in a patient who's fit for intensive chemotherapy? I note there were at least one presentation I saw at ASH of venetoclax plus 7+3. What about that strategy? What about venetoclax hypomethylating agent instead of 7+3? Do you ever have patients who come in and ask for it?
Absolutely. So both of those scenarios are applicable. So we had presentations from the MD Anderson group looking at FLAG-IDA plus venetoclax, both in some upfront patients and also in the relapse refractory setting. And, you know, it's early days. And I think the challenge with intensive regimens is that the response rates in those populations are already usually fairly high. And so it's difficult in a single arm study to sort of assess what contribution another drug like venetoclax may be making. So that muddies the waters a bit. Rich Stone from Dana-Farber had a poster on 7+3 plus venetoclax and, you know, very few patients, I think 9-10 or something like that. But definitely, you know, I think these are going to be viable strategies. The second part of the question is, to me, the more exciting one. And that's, you know, can we do away with intensive chemotherapy? Is this strategy a low intensity backbone therapy like a hypomethylating agent plus venetoclax? Is it a replacement for intensive chemotherapy? And I'm very hopeful that it will be. So, you know, there's nothing about this disease biology in older patients that should make us think that it wouldn't work in younger patients, you know, just biologically. And there's no reason to, in my view, subject, like we were talking about earlier, subject a younger patient to intensive chemotherapy just because they can tolerate it if it's not giving us any added benefit. So you asked if there are scenarios where, you know, we would consider using this regimen in a fit patient. First of all, yes. We have a clinical trial at my institution looking at that question specifically. So we're taking younger patients, and what I say younger, I mean 18 to 59 years old, who are perfectly fit for intensive induction chemotherapy, but who have a disease feature that makes it less likely that they'll respond to that strategy. So in other words, adverse risk cytogenetics mostly. And we're saying, yeah, these are people that could tolerate intensive chemotherapy, but we're not going to do that. We're going to give them this, you know, likely safer, more, you know, respective of quality of life type strategy. And we think that that would be just as good, if not better. All those patients, of course, will go on to get a stem cell transplant. So these are people who have a curative option. So that's one way we're looking at this. And we hope to be able to present that data in the coming years. But, you know, I spoke about this at the symposium. I mean, I've had a couple of patients who are Jehovah's Witnesses. And that's a religion where, as every hematologist knows, you know, has pretty strong strong feelings about no blood product transfusions. And when these patients get a disease like leukemia, historically, you know, there's been nothing we could do for them, because without being able to give blood product transfusions, you certainly can't give these people induction chemotherapy. They wouldn't survive. And you certainly can't take them to a transplant. So I've had a couple patients now who have those religious beliefs, who are young and otherwise healthy, who have come to me, usually after being turned away by multiple different other places, because that's, you know, historically, you know, you can't get induction chemotherapy, so you can't get treated. And anecdotally there, we've gotten access to this therapy for them, and we're having some really pretty incredible results. We're going to be publishing this hopefully soon as sort of an anecdotal thing. But so, you know, there are people out there who, for whatever reason, despite being young and healthy, you know, just aren't candidates for intensive induction chemotherapy. And I think ultimately someday we might be able to say, yeah, you know, we've got a good therapy for you.
Yeah, you know, you presented one of those cases at the symposium, as 35-year-old woman who was a Jehovah's Witness, and the room was absolutely silent as you were discussing that case. I mean, people were just like holding their breath thinking about it. And I guess she got through it. Her hemoglobin went down to 7.2, platelets 35,000. What's her current situation?
I mean, this is an amazing story. And, you know, I caution everyone to be careful about anecdotes and stuff. But this particular woman is 18 months into treatment, has obviously never needed a transfusion, but never even came close, or, you know, as close as she came is what you quoted. Her blood counts are quite good. We dose reduce the azacitidine to make some accommodations for her, but she's living a pretty close to normal life. She takes her pills. She comes in for the azacitidine treatments regularly. Bone marrow biopsies don't show any evidence of disease. It's quite remarkable what's happened with her. And, you know, I mean, this is the future. This is how we're going to treat this disease in the future.
So speaking of that, I mean, right now when you look at it, is the depth of response that you see here and getting a patient in shape for transplant indirectly, does it seem to be similar to 7+3?
Right. So we're in our infancy in understanding this. You know, I'll take the residual disease question first. I mean, the depth of responses seems to be quite good. We've reported at our poster at ASH that these patients frequently achieve MRD negativity by flow cytometry, multi-parameter flow cytometry at least. When you dig down deeper into more sensitive methods like digital droplet PCR, we can still get some people into an MRD negative state. But when you lower the bar, I guess raise the bar, it's harder to clear it. But I think this regimen has the potential to allow for very deep responses. And, you know, practically, when you look at the clinical experience here, the duration of response is a easy surrogate to say, well, you know, the responses must be deep. But as to the question you asked, you know, how well can this prepare a patient for a transplant? I think it's still an open question, but Keith Pratz presented a really nice paper where he looked at the 300 patients from the phase one study, whether they got low-dose cytarabine with venetoclax or hypomethylating agent with venetoclax. And even though those patients were deemed unfit for intensive chemotherapy, 10% of them, after achieving a remission, went on to get a stem cell transplant. And so that was about 30 patients he reported on, so still small numbers. But the post-transplant experience for these patients is quite good. With, you know, 2 years of follow-up, I think something like 60% of them are still in long-term remission. And so I think what this shows is that a patient who's not a candidate for intensive induction chemotherapy, who gets into a remission with this pretty safe, very effective, and sort of outpatient-oriented therapy, can still be considered for a curative intervention like a, you know, an allogeneic transplant. And all these were reduced intensity transplants, of course, which is a routine thing that we do for patients with comorbidities into their late 70s now. So I think it's really exciting. And I think what this shows is that, you know, this will perhaps expand the pool of patients who can get a transplant and get cured. I mean, I think that remains to be seen.
That's really interesting. So you're saying really that the criteria for someone to be able to receive 7+3 is maybe more stringent, demanding than the criteria to get a transplant.
Absolutely. And that's not anything new. That has been the case on the ground for the last 10 years. So we have lots of patients who aren't candidates for induction, but they're fine candidates for a transplant. The question is, if they're not candidates for induction, how do you get them in remission to even get them to the transplant? Before, we didn't really have a way. So it was sort of like making a decision, if you can't get induced, you can't get transplant. But that was only for this sort of logistics reason that, you know, there was no way to get them in a remission. But we always knew that if we could get them in remission, like with azacitidine alone or something, that patient could go to a transplant just fine. It's just that that was a rare event, a rare occurrence. So I think that's a well-accepted precept in our field, or at least it should be. I think it's an important message. If people aren't buying into that, they should really consider that, that not being a candidate for induction doesn't mean you're not a candidate for a transplant.
So you refer to patients who have targetable mutations, and I am curious about the older patient with either a FLT3 or an IDH mutation. When we asked this faculty panel about those people, in general, for both FLT3 and IDH, we saw for older patients, people were saying azacitidine and venetoclax, but a few said all three. So targeted therapy plus azo venetoclax. How do you approach these patients?
So when we think about FLT3, it's important to look at the subset of patients with azo venetoclax who had a FLT3 mutation and look at them specifically and compare their outcomes. And at least with respect to response rates, if you have a FLT3 mutation, there's really no change in your ability to get into a remission with a venetoclax-based regimen. We can argue as to whether your duration of response might be shorter with a FLT3 mutation. I think the jury's a little bit out on that, but I could be convinced that perhaps that's the case. But just in terms of getting a patient into a remission, if at the moment it's just as successful whether or not you have a FLT3 mutation with the azo-venetoclax regimen, I personally am not too enthusiastic about piling on in the upfront setting, you know, with a patient population who is comorbid and maybe more susceptible to side effects and things. In the setting of a clinical trial, great. I mean, I think that's a great clinical trial question. I'd love to see that data, and I welcome that type of an approach. The corollary to the question is, once a patient's in a remission, can you extend their remission by adding a FLT3 inhibitor into the mix and maybe alternating with the venetoclax or doing something? And again, I think great question. I'm not ready to pull the trigger on that in the upfront treatment setting for my patients, but I really welcome people like Rich and others doing those trials. But for the moment, if you were to ask me, would I bank on a strategy of a FLT3 inhibitor alone or with azacitidine in the upfront setting with a newly diagnosed AML patient, or go with venetoclax azacitidine, I'd still choose the venetoclax azacitidine. But admittedly, you know, there's some research out there and some clinical trials in progress looking at that question, and perhaps some day we'll decide that it is better to go after the FLT3 upfront. But at the moment, I'm not ready to do that.
You know, it's really interesting being in CME and so many new drugs, new therapies coming out, you know, how people in practice actually respond to it. And, you know, when we first started to hear about this story about venetoclax combinations, it's only been less than 2 years, I think. We started talking about it a lot in our CME programs. It was obvious how much it was going to change things. And it looks to me, from what we can tell in our surveys, that people have jumped all over it. I've really been surprised, a lot more than other advances, and you can really understand why. But I'm curious, I'm sure you get tons of questions and cases that people want to ask you about. What are some of the common issues and questions you're hearing about from docs in practice, and whether there are any myths or misperceptions about this strategy that you've observed?
Right. So I think we covered a lot of them. The big questions I get are, what is the real risk for tumor lysis and do I have to admit the patient? What's the deal with dose reductions for antifungals and should I do that? And then the biggest one is either managing cytopenias or just concern about getting into a cytopenia situation. You know, what I tell people with that latter question, you know, when they say, you know, I've got this very frail 90-year-old, you know, I don't want to blow away his or her bone marrow with this regimen, I really don't think that that is a major consideration for most people. I mean, what I like to say is, I can't really think of the patient that was too frail or too sick to at least deserve a shot at this therapy. And we've had a lot of really kind of Lazarus situations with people who were frail and sick because of their leukemia, and they needed an effective therapy. And once they got that, they recovered quite nicely. So what I would say is that with the mitigation strategies for the cytopenias, the sort of things we cover, the early bone marrow biopsy, the taking breaks, the using growth factors, in almost all cases, you can really manage that issue. And, you know, I don't want to downplay or diminish it, but for the most part, we haven't had major complications related to the cytopenias. And so a lot of this comes with experience, comfort, familiarity, maybe having someone who's done this a little bit more walk you through the first few and, you know, have someone to bounce questions off of. But, you know, I would say the number one sort of concern, myth, if you will, is that this is sort of like really intensive therapy that will render a bone marrow aplastic and unrecoverable. That's just not my experience with this.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, when you think about quality of life. And this comes up with CLL, you know, because now you have venetoclax up front, particularly with obinutuzumab versus BTK, ibrutinib now, acalabrutinib. And, you know, of course, BTK inhibitors are not very easy necessarily to take. They have a lot of quality of life issues. But on the other hand, the venetoclax, you hear almost nothing. Do you see any quality of life, any side effects?
That, you know, when patients ask me about this, sometimes my answer, I see in their eyes like, they feel like I'm like a snake oil salesman or something, because it really does sound too good to be true. I, you know, after treating, I don't know, 170 plus patients now with this regimen, I mean, there's very little I can hang my hat on in terms of like when I go over consenting these people to tell them what are the major risk factors. You know, there are some GI issues. I think a lot of that has to do with taking 4 big tablets every day and just like getting those down and swallowing those can be an issue for some older patients, some younger patients too. So that alone is an issue, but there's some kind of one-off stuff or odd reactions that I've seen, but almost nothing consistent enough to tell people that, you know, like when you counsel someone with ibrutinib, you know, these are the things that we frequently see. So I don't know what that makes me. Like I said, sometimes I feel a little, you know, guilty about that or bashful because, you know, I'm telling them that, you know, this has a high chance of working and, you know, to expect very few, if any, side effects. But that's been my experience.
So the last thing I want to ask you about is new approaches to AML, particularly for patients with adverse cytogenetics. Specific, we're starting to see some agents that are targeting, I think, P53, for example. Any new strategies, you know, along the line of a biologic like venetoclax that are out there that have you excited?
Yeah. You know, this APR246 drug that targets P53 is really cool. It's looking good. This is the graveyard for our disease. You know, patients do so poorly. There are so few effective therapies. Chemotherapy is, you know, for many of us now, a non-starter. We won't even give it. Coleman Lindsley from Dana-Farber from Rich Stone's group presented CPX351 with P53, and those patients do just as poorly with CPX351 as they do with intensive induction chemotherapy. So we badly need something for these patients. And APR246, you know, it's sort of engineered to modify or to target patients with P53 mutations. And David Salmon, as well as a French group, gave really nice presentations back to back on MDS and some AML patients with P53 mutations. And I think for the first time looking at that presentation, I think we can have some real reason to have a lot of hope for these patients and maybe have another targeted therapy we put up on the wall with a drug that kind of is the key for that lock. You know, FLT3, IDH, now maybe P53 is an opportunity. And, you know, as you know well, Neil, in the history of oncology, we've often gone from things going from a bad risk to a good thing just because you have a treatment. So, you know, Herceptin and pH-positive ALL, you know, those used to behave very badly until we had treatments for them. And APL, same thing. So, you know, I think there's a long history of converting a bad actor to a good actor just because you finally get the key for that lock. So I was really excited about that. I'm really hopeful.
Somebody tried to explain to me how these new drugs work. It's not exactly like other, you know, sort of agents, TKIs, et cetera. How does this actually work?
So, you know, P53, of course, is an important gene that allows cells to properly die when that's indicated. And part of the problem when you have a mutated P53 in a cancer cell is that that will, you know, sort of by definition, confer resistance to external signals that should trigger a cell to die. Chemotherapy, for instance, you know, some degree of toxicity, you know, you trigger a pathway, one of the end common signals in that pathway is P53, cell dies. But if you mutate that signal, then you're getting this external stimulus that, hey, look, things are really bad here, you should go ahead and allow a cell to die. P53 doesn't allow that. So just sitting through this presentation and from what, you know, really little I know that's already been presented about APR is that this drug can sort of bind to the mutated form of P53 and structurally convert it over to the wild type version of the protein. And in so doing, allow a cell to properly die when exposed to a stimulus or a situation in which that's appropriate, like being a cancer cell. I mean, you know, cancer cells, they're still maintain some, I don't know if dignity is the right word, but there's some part of them that know there's something wrong. And if you, you know, allow normal situations to take place, they're going to die or try to, unless the cancer cell is hijacking some pathway that's preventing that. So this sort of restores that normal steady state and allows, you know, a cancer cell to die properly, which is what the body is trying to do. So that's, I think, a very basic overview of how this works. But, you know, I mean, a couple of years ago, if you would have said that P53 was targetable, I think a lot of people would have laughed at you. You know, it's not a typical kinase and, you know, it's not, you know, so I think the world is changing and we're getting into being able to look at targets that were formerly thought undruggable and saying, yeah, there's a strategy here.
So P53, as you mentioned, is seen in a lot of cancers. Is there any evidence that these kinds of agents are going to work outside there?
Absolutely. It's my understanding that this drug started in ovarian cancer or has had some exposure or experience there. So perhaps, as happened so many times in the field of oncology, to brag a little bit for us heme people, you know, something big starts in heme and it extends out into oncology. TKIs, you know, monoclonal antibodies, all those started in blood cancers and have had a huge impact on, gosh, so many solid tumor patients. And so, you know, I think this may be perhaps another opportunity there.
That's a great point. I hadn't really thought about it. What about tolerability issues with these new agents?
With APR. Yeah. You know, I mean, I think in general, there were some toxicity issues, nothing out of the ordinary. You know, me as a listener, a non-participant in the clinical trial, picked up on as concerning. And certainly, you know, for the degree of how bad this disease is, I think most of us and most of our patients would have a, you know, pretty high threshold for toxicity issues. But nothing stood out to me as overly concerning with respect to toxicity.
What's the connection between P53 and Del17P? And would you expect, you know, these agents to work on that?
So P53 is on 17P. So the gene is on that region of chromosome 17P. So if you have a mutation in the gene, you can have the impact of that mutation. But if you just get rid of it, you also basically have kind of the same situation. So I think they're really talking about the same thing in many cases, if not most cases.
But I mean, do you think these kinds of agents would work in that situation?
I honestly don't know. If you don't have a mutant copy of P53 and you just have the region deleted, it may not work. They might have excluded those patients. You might have to have like a point mutation in P53. So yeah, I think you probably do.